Tomorrow will be our traditional JFK assassination special, but tonight our investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe devotes her entire program toward various areas of the JFK assassination, and she is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. And Linda, of course, we've moved her up because of the Thanksgiving holidays. And Linda, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Well, thank you very much. And happy Thanksgiving to everybody who is part of our Coast family and listening.
Super. We're doing our JFK special tomorrow. But tonight, you have your own series of special reports. Go ahead.
That's right. Tonight marks the 54th anniversary of the JFK assassination in Dallas, Texas. And by now, a 1992 National Archives law had mandated that all of the thousands of documents and photos from the murder investigation would be released to the American public by October 26, 2017. But the CIA and FBI are still blocking the release of thousands of records. Why? The answer appears to be in the power struggles of President John F. Kennedy and his powerful CIA director, Alan Welsh Dulles, who had been a major player in the agency for 10 years before Kennedy became president. In this and the following three reports tonight, JFK's assassination, covert CIA operations, and the UFO cover-up are tied together. Alan Dulles and his CIA colleagues were concerned when Fidel Castro was sworn in as Prime Minister of Cuba on February 16, 1959, after leading a guerrilla campaign that forced right-wing dictator Fulgencio Batista into exile. Castro wanted communism and strong economic collaboration with the Soviet Union that was a Cold War enemy of the United States. And that provoked the creation of American anti-Castro forces backed by the CIA. Former General Dwight D. Eisenhower was still U.S. president then, and by March 1960, he had allocated $13.1 million to the CIA to plan Castro's overthrow. 1 year later, President Eisenhower departed the White House as John Fitzgerald Kennedy was inaugurated as the 35th president on June 20th, 1961. Alan Dulles, a CIA director, was also MJ-1 in the Majestic 12 group originally created by President Harry Truman in 1947 to oversee the highly secret investigations and back engineering of extraterrestrial technologies retrieved from crash sites such as Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 and years beyond. Alan Dulles was both MJ-1 and director of the CIA in 1960 when he and Lieutenant General John Samford, director of the National Security Agency, both approved in September 1960 to reclassify the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit Summary Intelligence File, Top Secret Ultra, with a large magic stamp on top and the warning, only those persons with magic access may have access. Presumably, not even an elected official, such as the President of the United States, would automatically have magic clearance. But certainly Alan Dulles and President Dwight D. Eisenhower had full access to magic stamp documents about extraterrestrial craft and entities, both dead and alive, retrieved by special military teams from at least 1947 onward. But would John Fitzgerald Kennedy have been told everything about the UFO and ET secret upon his inauguration as the 35th president of the United States on January 20th, 1961? Only 2.5 months later, on April 4th, JFK approved a final Cuba invasion plan that Alan Dulles' CIA had developed over the preceding year for its CIA-sponsored paramilitary group, Brigade 2506, that created the Paramilitary Democratic Revolutionary Front, known as the DRF. Its goal and the CIA's goal was to get rid of Castro and his Soviet allies in Cuba, so close to the United States. But the April 1961 CIA paramilitary invasion was overwhelmed by Castro forces. As the U.S. involvement became apparent to the world, when American B-26 bombers attacked Cuban airfields, President Kennedy decided to stop the U.S. air cover. And that meant the Bay of Pigs CIA, a military invasion, had only half the forces that Dulles and his counterintelligence director, James Jesus Angleton, had counted on. Ultimately, Dulles was fired by Kennedy a few months later in November 1961, along with the deputy CIA director, Charles Cabell, whose brother, Earl Cabell, was mayor of Dallas, Texas, and confirmed in the recent National Archives release to have also been a CIA asset. President Kennedy appointed John McCone as more of a bureaucratic functionary to replace Dulles. The failed Bay of Pigs invasion helped to strengthen Castro's leadership, made him a national hero, and gave Cuba a communist government allied with the Soviet Union. And this eventually led to the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 and the assassination of President Kennedy on November 22, 1963, allegedly by CIA power brokers, including Alan Welsh Dulles. When Dulles was fired, the speculation is that he secretly remained MJ-1 in the Majestic 12 group to oversee the highly secret investigations and back engineering of extraterrestrial technologies retrieved from crash sites, such as Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 and others. Speculation is that Alan Dulles was angry and continued in that even more powerful role behind the scenes to counter Kennedy's increasing efforts to collaborate with the Soviet Union on space and going to the moon. But it has been more than half a century since then. So why would the modern CIA and FBI still want to cover up documents from the JFK assassination? In this four-part Earth File series, I have insights from two people. One is attorney Douglas Caddy, who was a close friend of CIA agent E. Howard Hunt, who had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency since its creation in the late 40s and was a mastermind of the 1972 Watergate DNC headquarters break-in along with G. Gordon Liddy. The first person to do an in-depth Skype video interview with Douglas Caddy in 2015 was Daniel List, producer and host of the Dark Journalist website and the 2014 documentary video, Agent Oswald, the CIA Patsy. I asked Daniel why he thinks the CIA and FBI still want to keep secret several thousand JFK assassination records. Here now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Daniel List.
The CIA continues to block access to their activities from this period, and that's very suspicious. Look at a character like Dulles, who was the CIA director when Kennedy was president. He already had an established network. And after the Bay of Pigs, when Kennedy fired him, according to some of those who were involved, Kennedy said to him, if this were Europe, I'd have to go and you could stay. But this is America and you have to go.
Meaning JFK fired Alan Welsh Dulles, who was CIA director from February 26, 1953 to November 29, 1961. That firing was tied to the Bay of Pigs failure. And then came the new CIA director, John McCone, who seemed to be only a functionary appointment by JFK.
No question. And there are quotes on record from Bobby Kennedy suggesting the same thing, that somehow McCone was more of an outsider, even though he assumed the responsibility of leadership at the CIA because he was appointed. But something that came out of the records that we can tie in here that I think is significant is that the mayor of Dallas, Earl Cabell, was a CIA asset. Now, we knew he was the brother of Deputy CIA Director Charles Cabell, and Kennedy had fired Cabell along with Dulles. So his brother now Earl Cabell, is the mayor of Dallas during the assassination. So when the cover-up hits, it's certainly helpful that the mayor is a CIA asset and that his brother is the former deputy CIA director.
Wow.
That's a very powerful piece that came out. But the records that they're holding up from the JFK Records Act in 2017 are the Jim Garrison files. They're included in the batch that they're not releasing. The file, in fact, is called simply CIA Secret Files on Jim Garrison and contains many pages that would tell us what they were so worried about with Garrison's investigation. What I think is interesting is his emphasis on aerospace and those connections around the CIA military-industrial complex of the assassination. They don't want those files released. And as an aside on this, Victor Marchetti, who was the special assistant to the deputy CIA director during the Garrison trial, said that Richard Helms himself had called the deputy and said, make sure that we're giving as much help to the defendant, Clay Shaw, that Garrison was trying to prosecute for conspiracy in the assassination of President Kennedy. One of the most important moments in Dulles' career is when Garrison had attempted to subpoena him for information regarding the CIA's role in the JFK assassination, and the government refused to give Garrison the ability under national security to subpoena Alan Dulles. So he was completely above the law at that point.
What date?
1968. When we look at Garrison's point of view and what he was trying to figure out when he was charging people with conspiracy in the JFK assassination, he basically felt that individuals who were in the CIA had created the conspiracy to kill Kennedy and carried it out. He thought it was a group inside the CIA. He didn't think it was the whole structure. And that goes back to what you said about McCone, because McCone, of course, being a functionary at the top, wouldn't have the knowledge of what these other aspects were doing. Now, one of the interesting things that JFK said about the CIA was that he was going to smash it into 1,000 pieces. Why would he have said that? What were they doing that was completely against the Democratic Republic principles of America that offended him to such a point that he wanted to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces and give their role back to the military?
What do you personally think is the answer to that question?
I think that Garrison's seeing them as a government within the government, that they were determining policy and that they were responding to a deep state that was giving them instructions about how to help support their bottom line instead of the interests of the country. Going back to the fact that Dulles was a Wall Street lawyer and, of course, his brother John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State. These people are in incredible positions of power, and they felt they had won World War II, and they really could split up the world and do favors for their interests and really shape the globe. This was their thinking on it. They didn't need the Congress. They didn't need the president. These people were functionaries. And the CIA's role grew like this. There's an incident that happened where there were these Italian elections that were taking place, and they needed a group to go in there and influence things. So they created something called the OPC, which was the Office of Policy Coordination. And this group started to do all these covert activities to sabotage elections in other countries after their mandate had expired. So they were still active. And so Truman said, well, let's get OPC back under the wing of the CIA. They're out of control. It's been theorized by people looking at this that the OPC, that wing that was doing these things to rig elections and overthrow governments and things like that, that they got control of the CIA that Truman had set up. This idea of the outsized power of the CIA was something that grabbed Garrison a lot in his investigation. And I think it's important to say that Garrison found that there were aerospace connections involved in the JFK assassination. And Garrison attributed that link, the aerospace companies and the CIA, back to the original assassination. One of the things that had shocked him when he was looking in New Orleans into Oswald's past was that Oswald had worked at the Riley Coffee Company, and a number of the friends and co-workers that he went to question at Riley had all gotten jobs at NASA or different aerospace companies. And in fact, Oswald was saying just before he left, when he was talking to friends, that he was going to work at NASA.
How far back can we get Oswald an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency throughout all of this?
Yes, I've got one piece that might help. The person who owned the Texas School Book Depository, where Oswald started work 6 weeks before the assassination, was Dryhold Byrd, D.H. Byrd. D.H. Byrd started the Civil Air Patrol. Oswald joined the Civil Air Patrol at 15 in New Orleans. His unit commander was David Ferry. David Ferry was a CIA pilot and a mafia pilot for Carlos Marcello. David Ferry worked and did jobs for Guy Bannister. One thing I found out about Bannister, which is very strange, is that when he was in the FBI in the early 50s, he was a UFO investigator for the FBI.
No kidding.
And there's a picture of Guy Bannister. They sent him to the Northwest, and there he is with this picture, and he's holding like a mini flying saucer. And it says, FBI man solves local saucer mystery. So you know how whenever we get around Oswald or we get around Kennedy, there's always this UFO thing. Now, what's weird is Guy Bannister knew Garrison. They were both in the FBI. And when Guy Bannister came to New Orleans and opened up a private investigator office, which was a cover for what he was doing, Garrison would meet with him for lunch. They discussed stuff. Now, the summer of 1963 is a very interesting period because Oswald has come back from the Soviet Union and he's living in New Orleans. But he is working for Guy Bannister, who is doing this kind of heavy-duty, right-wing, anti-Castro activity. But at the same time, Oswald's role, apparently, is to portray himself as a Marxist and a left-winger. This looks very much like a CIA operation from start to finish. And Jim Garrison's work with DA from New Orleans really figured out the Bannister angle. His determination was that on one of these pamphlets that Oswald was handing out was an address, and only one. The rest of them didn't have an address. But this one did, and it was 544 Camp Street. He figured out, because he knew Bannister, because remember, Garrison had been in the FBI also. Mm-hmm. He figured out, well, wait a minute, that's the address of the same building. There's two different doors. One side is one street, one side is the other, but they both go to the same office. And that's Guy Bannister's office. So he found this very unusual. Interestingly enough, Bannister died in 1964, shortly before the Warren Commission came out with their report. You know, a lot of people have said that was very suspicious timing because Bannister was so deeply involved with characters around the JFK assassination, like David Ferry and like Oswald, that he would have been just too hot to handle once the assassination had been accomplished by this covert group.
The implication is that he was murdered by the CIA so that his mouth would not open.
Yes. Interesting enough, Delphine Roberts, who was his secretary, was the one who identified Oswald and said, oh, yes, he was here in the office all the time. So Oswald was working with a right-wing anti-Castro operator, Guy Bannister, but Oswald was portraying himself as a leftist, putting out these Free Castro and Free Cuba pamphlets.
And so, George, the picture in this first half hour is that the whole Oswald, we'll call it the Oswald character, was like a theatrical product that had been being groomed and being created by the CIA to pretend to be an anti-Castro demonstrator, even if he was working with Guy Bannister in New Orleans, who was totally the opposite, 180 mm-hmm. degrees of right-wing, but both of them were working for the CIA. And as these reports unfold tonight, you will see that psychological warfare was such a big deal in that period of time, and that the repetition of a theme is a lot of different characters we are now beginning to understand from what has been released is that there was advance. There were people who knew that there was going to be, quote unquote, in November 19th, this was on Sunday, from reporters studying a release of some more of the recent archive releases. Here's the headline from The Independent in the UK. Lee Harvey Oswald's killer, Jack Ruby, told FBI informant to watch the fireworks hours before JFK.
Yep, they knew it. And welcome back to Coast, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe with us as she continues her special report on the JFK assassination. And somehow, let's go to Watergate stories. Linda, go ahead.
Yeah, they are linked. We have to go back 45 years now to June 17th, 1972, when those five men were arrested for breaking into the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate Hotel and office complex in Washington. They were James McCord. He was a former CIA agent working for Nixon's reelection creep committee. Frank Sturgis, Bernard Barker, Virgilio Gonzalez, and Eugenio Martinez. And two more men would be added to the break-in charges: E. Howard Hunt, who specialized in political warfare dirty tricks that included the CIA's disastrous April 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba during the John F. Kennedy administration. And Hunt had organized the break-in on assignment for the President Richard Nixon White House. And rounding out that Watergate 7 was G. Gordon Liddy, who was then working as Nixon's what they called creep attorney. After his World War II spy days for the U.S. Navy and Office of Strategic Services, known as the OSS, Everett Howard Hunt went to work in 1949 for the newly created Central Intelligence Agency. Hunt's specialty was political warfare, dirty tricks, sabotage, and propaganda, including the overthrow of Guatemala's government in the early 1950s and the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion to bring down Cuba's Castro that began on April 17th, 1961 and lasted for about 3 days before the invasion was overwhelmed. 9 years later, in 1970, CIA super spy Hunt was frustrated and resigned his Langley CIA position and went to work for Robert R. Mullen Company, a public relations subsidiary of General Foods that was all actually a front for the CIA. There, Hunt met attorney Douglas Caddy, and the two men became friends. Caddy insists that at the time, he did not know that the PR firm and Howard Hunt were both working for the CIA. One of Hunt's assignments in his CIA Mullen work was to head up a political dirty tricks unit for the Nixon White House. That is how Howard Hunt came to organize the burglary of the Democratic National Committee that took place at the Watergate complex in Washington on June 17, 1972, at about 3 o'clock in the early morning. Hunt's five henchmen were discovered and arrested by police. That's when Hunt reached out to attorney Caddy for help. Caddy was not a criminal law attorney, but found a lawyer to represent the five burglars. Hunt's bungled DNC break-in eventually brought down Richard M. Nixon, who resigned his presidency 2 years later on August 9, 1974. Not long before E. Howard Hunt entered the federal prison camp at Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, on April 25, 1975, for charges related to the bungled DNC break-in, Hunt asked to meet for the last time with his attorney friend Douglas Caddy at a restaurant in Washington. And Caddy recently talked to me for more than 3 hours in a recorded interview about what he learned were the true reasons behind the Watergate burglary and the UFO link to JFK's assassination from his old friend Howard Hunt. Here now from Houston, Texas, is attorney Douglas Caddy.
17th, 1972, at 3:05 Eastern Time, my phone rang, and it was Howard Hunt. He was calling me from his office in the White House, and he asked if he could come to see me on a very important matter. I have to see you right away. And at that time, I lived just a mile from the White House, and it turned out a mile from Watergate. So he arrived where I resided. He explained to me what had occurred at Watergate with the arrest and burglars. And he said that he and Gordon Liddy had escaped. They were in the Watergate Hotel, which was part of the whole building where the offices were in one part and the hotel was in another part. They had escaped. I realized this would put the president in dire peril. The arresting officer was Carl Schaffler. Carl Schaffler joined the Washington, D.C. Police Department in 1969. He was a military intelligence agent. He was assigned by military intelligence to join the police department. Carl Schaffler was supposed to go off duty on June 16th to go to Pennsylvania to join his family for his own birthday party. Instead, he said, I'm going to stay. So he was parked just a block away from the Watergate when he and his colleague in the police car got the call that a burglary was underway. But he had actually been informed 2 weeks in advance of the plans of the burglary by a confidential informant, Robert Merritt, who had obtained that information. So the military intelligence knew this was going down ahead of time.
But he didn't report his knowledge to anybody. He let it happen so that he could arrest them.
Correct. And it was Robert Merritt, who's one of his informants, who found out about the break-in. Rita Reed was her name. She listened in, and she heard this conversation go down. And the conversation went this way. There is a break-in that is planned. This will be the end of Nixon. We'll destroy Nixon. Someone at that time knew in advance of the break-in, and they were going to use it to destroy Nixon.
Okay, now, does that imply that G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt had that kind of information and that that was their agenda to destroy Nixon?
Nobody knows the answer. I'll just give you my answer, okay? James Angleton, who had destroyed JFK, wanted to destroy Richard Nixon, too. So Rita Reed heard this conversation. She immediately went to Robert Merritt's apartment the next day. Rita Reed is telling them what she had heard. There was a plan to break in the Democratic National Committee and the date and so forth. She asked Merritt not to tell anyone, but Merritt immediately told Schaffler, because even though Schaffler was married, they had a relationship. Mm. So Schaffler, with this knowledge, which would have been on June 2nd, 1972, with the break-in on June 17th, he had knowledge for 2 weeks in advance of the break-in. And he monitored it. That was his specialty, wiretapping and eavesdropping. He knew exactly how to proceed to monitor all the way up to the break-in. Now, inside the White House, while all this was going on, the military intelligence had its own operation in the White House to monitor Nixon. There were two operations. CIA agent Angleton was in charge of the CIA operation in the White House, of which Hunt was part. But in the White House, there was also military intelligence. I believe that Carl Schaffler, who came out of military intelligence, continued as part of this operation. The CIA, don't forget, Howard Hunt was taken into the White House upon the recommendation of Chuck Colson. But Howard Hunt went in there carrying two hats. In my opinion, he was still an active CIA agent. He's employed by the Mullen Company, which is CIA front. And Howard Hunt was a White House staff member. Between you and me, I think his primary loyalty was to the CIA. Mm-hmm. There are accounts that he sent back reports regularly to Richard Helms about what was going on in the White House.
Could we please go back then to the JFK assassination? And what did you know that E. Howard Hunt knew about the November 22nd, 1963 assassination of JFK?
Okay, well, I've given you the background of how I was representing Howard Hunt in Watergate. At a certain point in time, very early on, my role changed because I was served a subpoena to appear before the grand jury about a week after the Watergate case broke, at which point I could no longer represent Howard because I became a witness, okay? An attorney becomes a witness, he cannot represent any of those clients involved. And so I never saw Howard again until December, which was when the funeral of his wife Dorothy, had been killed in that plane crash in Chicago at the Midway Airport in December.
Of 1972.
72. On the internet, you can pull up the telephone conversation in November of 1972, right after the election, between E. Howard Hunt and Chuck Colson. And Chuck Colson recorded it, and it ended up on part of the court proceedings and on the internet. And Howard Hunt says, okay, the trial is coming up. We're all going to stand trial, and we remain quiet. We've got through the election, but now we're all going to go to prison, looks like, and we want to be paid. We want to be taken care of. That's what he says. He wants to be. We've been promised. We were promised we would be taken care of. Very little money has been forthcoming. And Dorothy was sort of the courier when there was hush money. And so if you listen to this conversation, Howard is given an ultimatum to Chuck Colson. Either you produce this money for us to for us and our families to survive while we're in prison by such and such a date, or else. Or else we're going to go public, you know. That's what he says. And Chuck Colson is going, because Chuck Colson knows he's recording it, and who knows who's listening in. He can't very well implicate himself in a conversation like that. And he says, well, Howard, and things like that, you know. And so what happened was Dorothy died, but in my opinion, Dorothy was murdered. It was sent a signal to Howard Hunt. You went too far. You went too far in threatening us, whoever us is, you know. And so Howard Hunt pleaded guilty in early January, but between the funeral and pleading guilty, he met with his four children. And he said to them, listen, if I don't plead guilty, they'll kill you. I'm afraid they'll kill you, so I'm going to plead guilty. It was a terrible situation for all of them. So going back, I saw Howard Hunt on Saturday, June 17th. I didn't see him again until the funeral there in Dorothy, where he crossed the parking lot and came over and held me and cried on my shoulder for a period of time. He was just distraught. You know, his eyes were just swollen red. It was really a terrible situation. And so because of my role, I've now become a witness for the prosecution and witness for the defense in this case, for both. So I did not see him again until the case was pretty much over, which was 1975. That would be the third time I saw Howard in all of Watergate. He called me up and said, well, I'm going to be going to prison. He was going to go away for 3.5 years, and he said, let's have dinner. I just want to thank you for what you did. So we agreed to meet at the Yenching Palace in Washington, which was a famous restaurant. So I arrive at the restaurant, and Howard Hunt is already seated in a booth. And so we chat. I knew this was probably the last time I would see Howard, at least for a period of time. And it turned out it was the last time I saw him at that dinner. And so I said, well, there's certain questions I have to ask you, Howard. So I asked him, the first question was, why did you all go into the Democratic National Committee? So he said, well, they were just supposed to photograph anything that had numbers on it. I was really, that was sort of an affront to say something so silly as that. And I said, well, Howard, really, come on. And he just shrugged his shoulders, you know. And I said, well, Howard, there was a burglary. There were burglars arrested. I said, you did not attend the trial because you had pleaded guilty. But I was a witness at the trial, both involuntarily for the prosecution and voluntarily for the defense. And the witness stand, I looked out, and there was this long, long table. And was full of all sorts of equipment. I said, Howard, I saw all that equipment, wiretapping, all sorts. And I said, so did you not go in to fix that bug? There was a Watergate bug inside the Democratic National Committee. And all he did was nod. He didn't say anything. He didn't want to verbalize it. He nodded his head. So I took that as an assent, you know. And then I got the impression he was uncomfortable with it. Things were proceeding, but I still had some questions. So I said, well, Howard, there was a prostitution ring. I read about that in the newspapers, and actually there had been a prostitution ring that had been broken up on Capitol Hill just 2 weeks before Watergate broke, a prominent prostitution ring involving many of the same people that were involved in the prostitution ring being run out of the Democratic National Committee. So I said, did you not go into the Democratic National Committee to get the list of clients of the prostitution ring? Because in the one on Capitol Hill, the U.S. attorney had gotten right away the list of clients through the book that had been kept by the lawyer who was managing the ring. So they knew who the clients were, and one of them actually was John Dean. And so I said, did you not want to get a list for purposes of compromise, you know, for blackmail and so forth? And once again, he just nodded. He didn't commit verbally. And so I said, Howard, you know, these are not sufficient reasons. Burglary is, nobody should engage in a burglary to begin with. But if you're going to engage in a burglary, you've got to have a reason. And these are not sufficient reasons to go into the Democrat committee, especially to risk the presidency over something like this. And so there's got to be a reason. And actually, there was a period there, I would say about 30 seconds, where he thought, and then he said, well, there was a reason. A reason we went in there was that we believed that inside the Democratic National Committee, there were Cuban government reports involving the Kennedy assassination. And I said, wow, Cuban government reports dealing with the Kennedy assassination, what would be in there? At that point, he didn't want to talk anymore. He just waved his hands in front of him. After that, it was about his going to prison and his children's situation, my situation. So the dinner was over, and we went out to Connecticut Avenue right in front of the Inching Palace. So I realized this is the last chance. I knew he was going to go to prison. This is the last chance I'll have. And said, Howard, you told me about going into these Cuban government reports and the Democratic National Committee and the Kennedy assassination. And what was in the reports? Why was Kennedy killed? Why were those reports so important? He said, Kennedy was killed because he was about to give our most vital secret to the Soviet Union. And I repeated, our most vital secret. What would that have been? He leaned forward and looked in my eyes, and he said, the alien presence. And he shook my hand and walked away.
And that phrase, the alien presence, is a phrase that you find that people who were working in Washington or in military in the 1950s to the 1960s, that was one of the codes, the alien presence related directly to crashes, whether it was Roswell or on the other side of the world. There were a lot of crashes from the 40s, 50s that the American public didn't hear about. And our government was intensely trying to get what they could perceive was very advanced technologies in these crashes that may actually have been planted as opposed to being legitimate crashes, a kind of Trojan horse syndrome, that we're dealing with something that wants to place in the minds and the hands of Homo sapiens sapiens certain technologies to get us to advance along certain paths, and that one man who had served in one of the Project Pounce teams said, eventually we began to realize that in some cases we were sent down red herrings on purpose as if to slow us down. In others, we were being accelerated. And these would all have been questions and issues for the Truman administration, for the Eisenhower administration, and that when John F. Kennedy was inaugurated in January of 61, he already had been exposed in his naval career and through his father, Joseph Kennedy Sr., to UFOs and the whole concept of other life forms.
What a story. More to come on Coast to Coast AM.